Whatever they will be doing it without Representative Mickey Leland of Texas, who, as many of you are aware, has now been discovered dead in the crash of his airplane on a fact-finding mission in Ethiopia. Reading from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, August 8th of 1989, a Washington Post story, Dateline Washington, headlined, Congressman's Plane Missing in Ethiopia. This plane would have gone down the day after my prediction or my statement that, in my opinion, black political leadership is being decapitated. The article reads in part, a small plane carrying Representative Mickey Leland, Democrat of Texas, chairman of the House Hunger Committee, and as many as 13 other people failed to arrive Monday at its destination, a refugee camp near the Ethiopian-Sudanese border, State Department officials said Monday. State Department spokesman Adam Shub, SHUB, said, quote, we are concerned about the welfare of Mr. Leland and his group, unquote, but aides to Leland said that because of a lack of communication systems and a ban on night flying in the rugged area, the congressman might simply have been unable to communicate his whereabouts to the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa. Among Leland's fellow passengers is Joyce Williams, an aide to Representative Ron Dellums, Democrat of Oakland, said Leland aide Timmy Jensen. Shub said Monday night that, quote, the whereabouts of the plane and the party are unknown, unquote. The plane, a de Havilland Twin Otter, left Addis Ababa at 10:40 a.m. local time, headed for Fugnido, F-U-G-N-I-D-O, a camp near Ethiopia's border with Sudan. The plane was to deposit the group in the camp and return to Addis Ababa. According to Shub, the embassy determined the party never reached the camp and the plane did not return to Addis Ababa. Pilots have a 5 p.m. deadline to return to the capital since nighttime flights are not allowed. Leland, a prominent member and former chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, was on an official congressional trip. Well, obviously, he has been discovered dead. It's worth noting, too, that there were a number of officials from the number of people who worked for the Agency for International Development on his flight. That organization has had a history of involvement with the U.S. intelligence agencies. The search for Representative Leland did not develop as quickly as many people would have liked. It has come under a lot of criticism, and it should be noted also that that search was being conducted in large measure by the U.S. military, and that it was the largest search or largest operation of its kind ever conducted by the U.S. military overseas. Reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, August 12th of 1989, this is a story by Richard Halloran, H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N, special to the New York Times, Dateline to Washington, August 11th. Headline, Staff of Lost Lawmaker Calls U.S. Search Slow. Representative Mickey Leland's staff accused the state and defense departments today of not doing enough to find the congressman, whose plane was reported missing in Ethiopia on Monday, and urged President Bush to give it his personal attention. Mr. Leland, a Democrat from Texas, was reported missing on Monday when his plane left Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital, for a refugee camp near the Sudanese border. 15 other people were aboard. The criticism appeared to reflect increased concern over the fate of Mr. Leland and the others on the plane, as Ms. Newsom acknowledged. Skipping down again. This afternoon, the White House, stung by the charges from Mr. Leland's staff, detailed what had been done to help. Marlon Fitzwater, the president's spokesman, called the search, quote, the largest, most comprehensive undertaking in recent memory, unquote. And again, the president has been a friend of Mickey Leland's for a long time, Mr. Fitzwater said. Again, quoting, he talked to Mrs. Leland. We've never committed such a comprehensive effort in a foreign country to search for anyone, unquote. Skipping down again, in Ethiopia, search planes, hoping to locate the missing aircraft by tracing two emergency signals picked up by satellite, failed to find any trace of the plane today. That last sentence again. In Ethiopia, search planes, hoping to locate the missing aircraft by tracing two emergency signals picked up by satellite, failed to find any trace of the plane today. The search included a day's flying by two American C-130s and a dozen Ethiopian aircraft. The C-130s concentrated on the mountainous area around Goba, southeast of Addis Ababa, and Mota, northwest of the capital. Those areas were out of the flight path of the Leland plane, which left here on Monday in heavy weather for Fugnido, a refugee camp on the western border with Sudan. The search is scheduled to resume on Saturday with four United States Black Hawk helicopters that arrived today on an Air Force C-5 transport plane. It also carried Representatives Gary L. Ackerman, Democrat of Queens, and Alan Wheat, Democrat of Missouri, and the House's Sergeant-at-Arms, Jack Russ. Ms. Newsom said that some of Mr. Leland's constituents had asked whether more would have been done if the congressman was not black. Quote, "We don't think it's a racial issue," she said. "Not at all, not at all. We think it's some kind of bureaucratic breakdown." Tended to put that in the famous last words category. Probably be Ms. Newsom's famous last words when her plane goes down, or when her apparent suicide, or when her enlarged colon and subsequent surgical complications and undetermined cause of death happens. But I don't think that that's, that slow search was any accident. One of the questions that I had concerning this incident, and we'll talk about Representative Leland and his political pedigree here in just a second, one of the questions that I had was whether perhaps in addition to searching or allegedly searching for Congressman Leland's plane, whether perhaps all of these aircraft and apparently satellites as well, which were involved in this operation, may have also been involved in surveilling Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia is a Marxist country, and as such, obviously a focus of activity by our intelligence community. There is currently a civil war going on there and an apparent U.S. covert operation as well. One wonders whether perhaps these planes and surveillance aircraft and perhaps satellites as well, if we're to believe the previous account, may all have been surveilling the daylights, as I believe they were, out of Ethiopia at the same time. Now, I want to make clear this is speculation on my part, but still, it, according to this account, is the largest operation of its kind ever undertaken in a foreign country. Word about just who was directing that foreign operation, or that particular operation, the largest of its kind, was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, August 9th of 1989. This is a New York Times story, again, datelined Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, headlined Congressman's Plane Still Missing. And it contains this, I'm not going to read the whole article. It says, Pentagon officials said Monday night that the U.S. Central Command, based in Tampa, Florida, but responsible for military activities in the Ethiopian theater, was sending aircraft to Addis Ababa to help in, quote, treating and evacuating, unquote, Leland and fellow passengers in the aircraft if it is found with survivors. Well, I wonder if perhaps the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida, was again involved with more than just looking for Congressman Leland. One of the things that I thought of, too, in connection with the disappearance of Congressman Leland was the fact that the space shuttle has been up on a highly secret military mission, according to reports reaching the press, to deploy a highly sophisticated electronic reconnaissance satellite. Whether there was any connection between that satellite and the satellite signals, or the satellite reconnaissance of the signals picked up in Ethiopia, is anybody's guess. Again, it was a highly secretive mission. In the past, the shuttle has been involved, apparently, with intelligence operations here on the ground. It's worth noting, too, that in particular in this regard, that when the KAL-007 flight that we touched on last week was bruising Soviet electronic air defenses, the intrusions of KAL-007 just happened to correspond with overflights by the shuttle at the time. And there have been a lot of accounts that the shuttle was in fact involved with some very sophisticated monitoring of the Soviet electronic air defenses. And again, I wonder if perhaps the search for Representative Leland's plane and all of these U.S. aircraft there might have been involved in testing some of the shuttles and or the satellite that it deployed. I wonder if whether perhaps some of its systems were being tested. Again, food for thought and grounds for further research, but the thing that leads me to suspect that may have been the case is I thought about that, and in discussion with a colleague during the week, I said it was my feeling that if that hypothesis was correct, then it would be essential to keep the search for Leland going until after the space shuttle returned. Now, it touched down, was scheduled to touch down this morning, and then later in the day, sure enough, we found out that, yep, tragically, Representative Leland's plane had been found. Everybody was dead. Of course, even if they'd been alive for a while, they wouldn't have stood much of a chance after all this time. Again, we can't draw any conclusions from that, but it is my suspicion that there was a whole lot more going on there than just looking for Representative Leland. It should be noted that when our national security establishment decides to move on something, they decide to move on something when it will scratch more than one itch at the same time. That's an absolute rule of thumb for our intelligence system, and again, I wonder whether perhaps they were testing some high-tech military toys as well, and if that had anything to do with the top-secret shuttle mission. But certainly, Leland was discovered after the shuttle returned to Earth, as I predicted he may very well be. I had a hunch that was going to happen. Whether or not my hunch is correct remains to be seen. Worth noting, too, although I'm not going to read it here due to the limitations of time, some of the aspects of Representative Leland's political pedigree. First of all, in addition to being a key member of the Black Political Caucus, or the Black Congressional Caucus, I should say, that will be evaluating Clarence Thomas as a judicial appointee in this upcoming battle, he also was very active on behalf of famine relief in Africa. He was very active in particular in trying to promote better relations between the political relations between the United States and Ethiopia, which, again, as I said, is a Marxist country, a Soviet ally, and as such a major focus of activity by our national security establishment and intelligence system. Again, he's chairman of the House Committee on Hunger. Any one of those things would have caused him to run afoul of the political far right in this country. Whether or not, as I suspect, his death was as a result of foul play, and whether my ruminations concerning the possibility of electronic surveillance of Ethiopia and perhaps even a bit of work on the shuttle or that satellite, that remains to be seen. But again, I said last week that, in my opinion, Black political leadership was being deliberately decapitated. Obviously, that Black political leadership no longer involves Representative Mickey Leland. Going to dedicate the next two songs to the late Representative Mickey Leland, and we will come back with the last part of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast.
Answer a
Tribute to the late Representative Mickey Leland. First, Abby Lincoln, A Change, or Brother, Where Are You? Then, of course, Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come. That's the late Sam Cooke. A lot of late people these days, huh? So you thought you were free, huh? Well, Mickey Leland's free. Unfortunately, you all, and me too, still have some problems. And one of the biggest problems we have is that the more one looks at what is going on, the more one is forced to, I think, if you're going to be honest with yourselves, and not many people are these days, I think an awful lot of people are in a state of absolute psychological denial, the more and more things like this begin to develop, it looks very much like the kinds of developments that took place in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. Now, very quickly, I'm going to review some information that we have turned to from time to time on this broadcast, and specifically, this is a description of what it was like to grow up, or what it was like to live in Germany during the rise of Hitler, what it was like subjectively. I'm going to read to you from a book called They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1933 through 45, authored by Milton Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, published in softcover by the University of Chicago Press, copyright 1955. And here's an account by Heinrich Hildebrandt, a teacher, of what it was like, in his opinion, to grow up, or to live, I should say. He was an adult at this time, to live in Germany during the rise of Hitler. He says, in part, "What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassured those who would otherwise have worried about it. Interrupting, think about Ronald Reagan's personal popularity and the role that played in the so-called Reagan Revolution. Continuing with Mayer's account. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. Skipping down. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness or acuity than most of us had ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, quote unquote, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures, quote unquote, that no patriotic German, quote unquote, could resent, must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. How is this to be avoided among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principis obsta and finem respice, resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly, and certainly how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might. Skipping down again. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next, and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act, or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, quote unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it, and it is not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone, quote unquote, is happy. One hears no protest, and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist, quote unquote. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, but you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends who are, naturally, people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller. Attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things, This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it. And then, you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than Step B, and if you did not make a stand at Step B, why should you stop at Step C? And so on to Step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Jew swine," collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the meal times, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level, you live. You have been living more comfortably every day with new morals and new principles. You have accepted things that you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. Again, Step C is not so much worse than Step B, and if you did not make a step at B, stand at Step B, why should you at Step C? And so on to Step C. That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast. Now, all of our archived broadcast shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication company. The name of that company is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They're located at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. I should also mention that neither myself nor this station makes any money off of this announcement. This is FYI. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.